Hello, and welcome to our audio blog version of Swim Lessons, where SWM provides the latest news and insights from the world of financial institutions. My name is Robert Wilkins. I'm an associate here at SWM, and we are going to talk a little bit today about wire transfers and Regulation E in a recent case where the CFPB provided an interesting opinion on the applicability of wire transfers to Regulation E and the Electronic Fund Transfer Act. Joining me today is Alex Wade, also an associate here at SWM. He's a part of our regulatory compliance and litigation management practice groups. Hey, Alex, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Robert, for that fantastic introduction, and I look forward to discussing this topic with you.
All right, thank you very much. So, as I mentioned, we are going to talk about a case involving the state of New York and Citibank dealing with some wire transfers and consumer protections that may or may not be applicable in that particular instance. So we may have written about this before, I don't recall, but just for the sake of getting everyone up to speed, Alex, why don't you tell us a little bit about this state of New York versus Citibank case?
Absolutely, would be happy to. So on January 30th of this year, the New York Attorney General Letitia James filed a lawsuit against Citibank for Citibank's allegedly conduct for failing to protect and reimburse victims of fraud. Now, in that case, the key question really boiled down, and for purposes of this blog, really boils down to which law should the parties have applied, whether what should it be UCC or Reg E when a scammer steals money from a customer's bank account via a wire transfer. This is a hotly debated topic, and it does have some important potential implications that could arise. Basically, in that case, Letitia James and the New York State Attorney General stated that Citibank failed to honor these victims of fraud and failed to apply the limits of liability and protections offered under Reg E. Instead, Citibank had applied the UCC, which has less stringent consumer protection standards. And additionally, Letitia James took issue with the fact that Citibank failed to provisionally credit these victims of fraud, and also that the fact that Citibank's affidavits regarding these unauthorized transactions made no reference of Reg E and the limits of liability. They simply were tailored towards UCC. So that's basically, in a nutshell, what the complaint alleges for purposes of this blog. Letitia James and the Attorney General, they do reference other issues and complaints. They take issue with Citibank's systems and procedures, and that Citibank failed to prevent the fraud due to these systems and procedures. But for purposes of this blog, we want to focus on the initial aspect there regarding which law applies to these victims of fraud when a wire transfer is at play here, and when a scammer steals money from a customer's account via wire transfer. And as far as the complaint, again, that was filed at the beginning of this year. After that, Citibank actually moved to file a motion to dismiss as anticipated. What was interesting, we had trade organizations such as the American Bankers Association filed an amicus brief in support of Citibank's position. And for purposes of this blog, we actually saw that the CFPB chimed in into the case as well when the New York Attorney General filed its opposition. The CFPB actually filed an amicus brief in support of the New York Attorney General's position, which is important and, again, is the purpose of this blog, which is something that we want to delve into a little bit. The motion period has since been ended. Everyone's fully briefed their motion, and that was as of June 25th. So we should expect a ruling here. It could take months for the judge to rule on the party's motions, but that's something that we're going to closely monitor. And yeah, with that, that's kind of the backstory there, Robert.
Thanks, Alex. Now, this wire transfer world is really in both you and my wheelhouse, right? As we deal with regulatory compliance a lot. And we're going to dig into sort of the details of both briefs, the banker's brief and the CFPB brief. But just at a high level, how shocking would you say the CFPB's decision was to say that wire transfers were in fact covered by Regulation E and the EFTA?
I think it's very shocking, and we'll get into that, or I'll get into that a little bit more. It basically upends long-standing industry practice that's been practiced by financial institutions for decades. So the fact that the CFPB chimed in and took the position that Citibank failed to apply the Reg E protections is surprising to say the least, and does have important implications. So,
right, I completely agree. I know when we, as long as I've been working here, at least whenever we get questions about consumer liability for fraudulent transfers, I mean, wire transfers, automatically we go to the UCC. Don't ever look at Reg E because it's carved out, right?
Correct. So, yeah, that's always been our approach here as well. Yeah.
So very strange for the CFPB to come out, especially the way it did. But like I said, we'll get into a little bit more about what exactly the CFPB said in a moment. For background, though, I think it's important for us to just briefly touch on one of the things you mentioned as far as the law that applies, right? So mm-hmm. General operating procedure has been wire transfers are under the purview of the UCC, right? And so when we look at the UCC, there's a whole section in there, usually Article 4A. It's in a different division in California, but mm-hmm. under all UCCs, there is a section that deals with funds transfers, also referred to as payment orders. And on the UCC side, for a wire transfer, they are generally presumed to be authorized as long as a certain set of conditions are met, right? So that mm-hmm. means the bank and the sender agree that the orders are authorized by a security procedure. The security procedure is commercially reasonable, and the bank proves that it accepted the order in good faith and in compliance with security procedures and any agreements with the sender. So, you know, if the sender said, I'll never send wires to, you know, whoever, company B, and we send a wire to company B, it doesn't matter if our security procedures were okay. So we can't violate that agreement. But generally speaking, if we have commercially reasonable security procedures and the sender or the member or customer has agreed that the orders that are sent pursuant to that security procedure are authorized, then the UCC says liability for that wire transfer is with the consumer, right? Because we followed all the commercially reasonable procedures. Of course, that's a big deal because, as you'll talk about, Reg E has a different paradigm.
Correct. And I think that was a good kind of backdrop there, the UCC, and kind of enter the play here with Reg E. And under Reg E, Reg E defines an unauthorized electronic fund transfer from a consumer's account initiated by a person other than the consumer without actual authority to initiate the transfer and from which the consumer receives no benefit. So there is a strict definition of an unauthorized transfer under Reg E that applies to someone or transaction that is initiated by a person other than the consumer. Once that is triggered, Reg E does offer very consumer-friendly limits of liability as opposed to UCC, which is not as friendly as regard or consumer-friendly. As far as those limited tiers of liability, if a consumer provides notice within 2 business days upon stolen or loss or theft of an access device. If the consumer provides notice within 2 business days to the financial institutions, their liability is limited only up to $50. I mean, that's pretty significant, right? And then if the consumer provides notice after 2 business days, their liability is limited up to $500. And then there's a third tier that we like to call the unlimited liability tier that if the consumer customer provides notice after 60 days upon receiving the periodic statement that reflects the unauthorized transfer, that the consumer could be potentially on the hook for all those transfers that occur after the 60 days until they actually provide notice. So as you can see through these three tiers, they're very consumer friendly, meaning that if they all depend on when the consumer provides notice. If the consumer provides notice early on of an unauthorized transfer, they're limited up to $500 potentially, right? So if we're talking about potential thousands of dollars of unauthorized transfers, the consumer liability would be limited there. Those limits certainly are not present in UCC. Again, very consumer friendly.
Right. And I think, you know, the main takeaway we wanted to provide with that background is, look, if wire transfers are covered under UCC, then for a consumer, you know, they're liable, mostly going to be liable for an unauthorized transfer so long as commercially reasonable security procedures were used. If wire transfers are covered under Regulation E, then there's huge protection for the consumer, and ultimately the financial institution is going to be mostly responsible. So again, the CFPB's position here was, I mean, it's a huge difference.
Right? Totally. Depending. Absolutely. Right.
All right. So with that background in mind, let's talk a little bit about what the bankers said on behalf of Citibank. So they included an amicus brief, or presented an amicus brief to the court, and they highlighted three main reasons why the state of New York in this case was wrong for suggesting that wire transfers are covered under Regulation E. So first, they looked straight at the statutory text of the Electronic Fund Transfer Act as well as the UCC. So under the EFTA, you know, they quoted the definition of funds transfer, which in part is essentially any transfer of funds initiated through an electronic terminal, telephonic instrument, or computer so as to order, instruct, or authorize a financial institution to debit or credit an account. So what the banker said was the way that's drafted, where it includes the term to instruct a financial institution, it already incorporates, you know, sort of the series of transactions that would otherwise make up a wire transfer, right? Mm-hmm. As you'll talk about, CFPB in New York kind of created this step-by-step process that makes a series of transactions that ultimately end in a wire. The banker said that EFTA already includes instructions, and having included that and then excluding wire transfers from the scope, you know, they obviously took into account all of the step-by-step procedures or transactions that would have occurred in the course of a wire transfer. Then they also looked at the UCC, and UCC defines a funds transfer as the series of transactions beginning with the originator's payment order made for the purpose of making payment. So again, the funds transfer definition contemplates the series of transactions that State of New York and CFPB have identified as being separate. The UCC already incorporates all those into, you know, a single definition of funds transfer. So number one, the textual argument. The second one, they included a laundry list of court decisions through all jurisdictions throughout America that have put wires under the jurisdiction of the UCC. So again, if the CFPB is correct in its interpretation, then, you know, decades of court jurisprudence and courts are just wrong, having interpreted both the EFTA and the UCC in excluding wire transfers from the scope of EFTA. So the banker said that that's just, you know, inconsistent with all the court.
And not just the courts. I mean, that's been industry practice for decades, right? So not only do we have the courts, but we have, you know, we have industry practice as well.
Absolutely. So statutory text, court cases, industry practice, and then just regulators, every regulator, banking regulator you can think of, they found some sort of guidance or discussion from those regulators showing that they have all interpreted Regulation E and the EFTA as to exclude wires. And, you know, not hard to find that information, likely because that's what the statute says and that's what the regulation says. So again, CFPB, Federal Reserve, FDIC, OCC, FinCEN, they quoted all of them and showed that throughout history, all of these regulators have interpreted the wire transfer exclusion to exclude the entirety of the transaction from the instruction from the customer slash member all the way to the payment to the beneficiary of the wire transfer. So after the banker submitted their brief to the court, we had, again, this bombshell brief submitted by the CFPB trying to explain why wire transfers were, in fact, covered by Regulation E and EFTA, despite the exclusionary language. Alex, why don't you tell us what was in that brief?
Absolutely. And again, in a surprising stance by the CFPB essentially rebutted all of those three claims that you made and basically said that it does not apply end to end, that the transfer can be broken into a series of transactions, right? And took a more hybrid approach, that the wire exclusion, again, does not apply end to end. And they actually took a more textual approach and basically argued that the text and the wire exclusion is clear as provided in Reg E. And I just want to provide a moment to kind of read what that wire exclusion says and what the actual text in Reg E states. Regulation E specifically defines an EFT to exclude any transfer of funds through Fedwire or through a similar wire transfer system that is used primarily for transfers between financial institutions or between businesses. The CFPB takes that language and states that the wire exclusion only applies to the bank-to-bank transfer. So let me take a step back here a little bit, right? When a financial institution connects the wire transfer capabilities to a consumer's online banking platform, and the consumer is able to log into their online banking platform and transfer funds out of their account to their institution, who would be the receiving institution in that scenario, and then the receiving institution thereby transfers the money to the beneficiary bank. The CFPB is taking the approach, and they're taking a hybrid approach, that that initial transfer out of the consumer's account to their institution, that initial transfer is covered under the Reg E, and that, again, the wire exclusion does not apply end to end. It does not encompass the whole wire transaction, as Citibank argues. Now, again, that approach, you know, to me, it was interesting that the CFPB used such strong words in its amicus brief as well. It made it seem that it was black and white, that this is how it was supposed to be for decades, and that the legislative and regulatory history supports this approach, right? And the CFPB took issue with the fact that Citibank had improperly applied the less protective standards under UCC, and again stated that there isn't a blanket carve-out for wire transactions, right? That it's a hybrid approach, that initial transfer is covered under Reg E. And then, yes, they conceded that bank-to-bank transfer, that, yes, that is actually covered by the UCC and the wire, and covered by the exclusion and therefore governed by the UCC, right? So, you know, again, the stance that the CFPB took, again, they were pretty strong in their words. That, to me, was interesting to see. And then based on those arguments, I mean, they laid out some of the regulatory and legislative history, but based thereon, the Citibank urged the court to deny Citibank's motion to dismiss related to their Electronic Fund Transfer Act claim.
Right. So, as you said, I for me, reading that, I was interested by the fact that they were so sure of themselves, right? Despite, again, decades of court cases ruling that wire transfers were under the UCC, decades of guidance from every banking regulator stating that wire transfers were covered under the UCC and not Regulation E. It seems odd that today was the day, or, you know, whenever that was filed, for them to come out so forcefully when, again, there's been so many cases prior to now that have you know, ruled the opposite of what they're suggesting was always the appropriate interpretation of Regulation E.
Right, and I completely agree with that. But what I will say is that I still think that the fact that the CFPB filed that amicus brief is troubling. You know, they are the main rulemaking body and body primarily responsible for interpreting the EFTA. Now, we all know of the Chevron case, which just came out as well. So that power has certainly been watered down, so to speak. And that could be another topic for another day. I mean, that was a big ruling in of itself. But for purposes of this blog, the CFPB is the main rulemaking body that's primarily responsible for interpreting the EFTA. So their stance in this amicus brief is troublesome. It's worrisome. And, you know, the CFPB took over this rulemaking authority in 2011 from the Federal Reserve. So we're talking almost, 13 years ago. And we haven't heard anything from them taken this aggressive of a stance regarding Reg E's application to the wire transfer, not even an enforcement action or anything. So the fact that they've had this authority for 13 years and they haven't done anything, being that it's so prevalent in the industry, I mean, I don't know of any of our clients or financial institutions that apply the Reg E standards of liability, limits of liability on wire transfers, right? That's just been industry practice. And the fact that the CFPB for 13 years hasn't come out and hasn't even an enforcement action, anything or spoken to this is troublesome to say the least. And, you know, it appears to me that, you know, the CFPB through this amicus brief, and actually their general counsel, the CFPB's general counsel, posted a blog about this particular, not about the, it referenced the case, but basically stating that, you know, institutions should be taking a hybrid approach, that if there's an electronic fund transfer, that even if there's a wire transaction involved, the exclusion doesn't apply wire to wire, that institutions are supposed to be applying the Reg E limits of liability. So between the amicus brief and the blog, it looks like the CFPB is trying to make a major legislative change without consulting with Congress or without following the notice and comment procedures that are there for this exact reason. I mean, it's mind-boggling. So, you know, I think, again, I want to mention the Chevron case because I think that certainly has some implications here.
And let me jump in really quick.
Sure.
Just because some people may not be familiar. So essentially, the Supreme Court in what was called the Loper-Bright case made a ruling that said a very long history of deference to administrative agencies was no longer appropriate. So the standard prior to the Loper-Bright case was, if there was an ambiguous statute, an agency could interpret the statute, and so long as they had a what would be considered a reasonable interpretation of that statute, the courts were to defer to that agency's interpretation. The Supreme Court essentially said that's not true, that is taking away from the judiciary's role in the separation of powers. So the courts are the ones with the authority to interpret statutes, and they will permit whatever level of deference to the agency's interpretation they see fit under the facts. So this certainly would be a case that I think is definitely impacted by that, as we are saying. You know, both sides are taking a widely divergent view of what is considered a wire transfer for the purposes of EFTA. And, you know, the CFPB, I think prior to this Loper-Bright Supreme Court case, certainly this is a permissible viewpoint, but is it the viewpoint that Congress intended? I don't know. And I think courts, with their new marching orders, will now, you know, this court in particular, will take a look at this case with, you know, they'll consider what the CFPB said, but no longer with the same sort of deference that would have been the case prior to the Supreme Court's recent decision. So, as you said, that case definitely will seem to impact this one. Briefly, I just want to talk about some of the practical impacts of this, right? So, if we go forward and the CFPB's interpretation wins out that Reg E covers wires, you know, at least what I can see as some of the practical impact on wire transfers are, you know, they're going to become less timely, right? So a financial institution is going to want more time holding that money probably before they send it, so that, you know, they're not left holding the bag on a fraudulent transfer. They make fees may increase for wire transfers, again, to account for the risk that is associated with these or with a Reg E liability shift. And then some FIs may just stop doing wire transfers altogether, right? Because the risk becomes unacceptable, especially wire transfers are typically larger dollar transactions, I would say. So if Reg E is the appropriate law, then and a consumer can shift all that liability except for, you know, 50 or 500 bucks back to the FI, the financial institution may just decide, you know, we're not going to do those anymore.
I agree. Or, you know, I think there's going to be a concerted effort, because right now it really, they may put, you know, kind of limits around the wire transfers if they continue to do it. For example, they may turn off those services on online banking and require consumers to come in person to make a wire transfer, right? That definitely would not be covered under the EFTA, right? If a person's actually coming to the institution with a payment order and they're from their bank sends it to the beneficiary bank, that would be covered under the wire exclusion, and UCC would apply. But I think in the meantime, as far as further outcome, I think just given the uncertainty with this case and the divergent opinions and arguments here, I think financial institutions should do a preliminary review and evaluation of their wire services, just to see if, depending on how the court rules, what changes they're gonna need to be made. I think it doesn't hurt to be proactive in that regard. For example, our wire transfer forms, do they only cite to the UCC or provide the UCC requirements? Do our affidavits, what do those look like? I think financial institutions should start doing that preliminary evaluation to get ahead of the curve. And what I will say, although this court may come down with a ruling, that ruling would be in the Southern District of New York, which is in the Second Circuit. That ruling wouldn't be binding for those of us here in California, which is in the Ninth Circuit, right? However, courts could use that ruling from the Second Circuit or the court in New York as persuasive authority, right? But it wouldn't be binding yet here in California unless a California court comes up with its own ruling based on a case filed by potential consumers. So,
and I think we've seen California courts, you know, like consumers and like to protect consumers. So it would not be a reach, I think, for us to expect a California court to rule in a similar manner if, you know, if New York comes down on the side of the CFPB.
I agree. And actually, just to touch on, I know we didn't really want to, you know, speak too much on Chevron, but I think it just plays too much of a role here. But I think that's one of the issues that we're going to see with the Chevron ruling, is that now that rulemaking, or, you know, that interpreting authority is taken away from the regulators and left to Congress and the courts to interpret vague statutes, we may see a difference of rulings from nationwide, from different courts, right? For example, here, the Second Circuit could have a ruling that Reg E, that the wire exclusions, it applies end to end, right? That ruling could come out of New York, but here, if we have a case in California, a court could very well rule the other way, right? So I think, you know, speaking to the Chevron ruling, that's something that could come from this, that there might not be as much
uniformity
exactly that was previously provided.
Right. So absolutely, that Chevron case, Loper Bright, is the more recent case, will definitely have tentacles that, you know, grab far and wide, and I'm sure we'll be writing and or talking much more about that in the coming months. So Alex, did you have anything else to add before we get out of here?
That's it. Thank you all for tuning in to our first audio blog, And if any questions, you know where to find us. And yeah, we'll be tracking this case for sure going forward.
Yes, please. So for more information about this case or any other news and insights from the world of financial institutions, please visit our website, www.swmllp.com. And you can also find us on LinkedIn, where we post a lot of stuff that's going on with the firm, events, appearances, and different news items as well. So thank you very much, and we will talk to you again soon.